Good morning. It's good to be back with you, joining you here in 2025. We made a choice last week. Beth took us into the beginning of the year with a talk that I feel didn't get enough appropriate laughs. Her talk last week was called Let's Get Stoned. And I told her that I spent 20 minutes hotboxing my car before coming in, only to realize that she was talking about literal stones. So it was a great start to the new year, promising start to where we're going to go in this year. Really excited. And, you know, we thought, why not just dive right in to the deep end with a little bit of a conversation around a simple topic of identity and consciousness and who is the I that we refer to. When we first introduced this topic here in pre-talk, I had some of the expected responses, including one person who, when we asked the question of who is the I that we're referring to and what is the self and does it exist outside of our mental constructs and all that, the response was, why do we need to talk about this? Can we just simply let it be? And that's a fair response. That's Lisa's response. Because any time that in life I've ever raised these really, really deep questions, or I'll listen to a podcast, I'll read a book, and it's just got some really great thing to, you know, wrap my mind around, and I want to kind of toss it around with Lisa, and poor Lisa is so accommodating and so patient, but she just doesn't have the desire to ask those deeper questions or wrestle with it. She does a much better job of simply accepting reality as it is. Whereas there are some of us who are perpetually gnawing at the edges of who are we? And we're like a dog with a bone where we can't stop asking the questions. You may identify with this or not. The more you ask, the more you uncover. And do you ever get a feeling that it's like once you know something, you can't unknow it? And once you ask the right kind of question in the right kind of way, you can't unask it. You can't take that back. You can ignore it, but it's kind of sitting there. So we want to raise some deep questions in the coming weeks because it's January, it's the winter. This is the perfect time to spend in self-contemplation, in navel-gazing, in hours of meditation as you wonder exactly who is the you that is observing those thoughts. Now, we're not going to go that deep, but I want to challenge us with some questions that don't have easy answers. Because I feel that it's good to ask those kind of questions, to ask the questions of ourself that promotes a deeper understanding of this reality that we exist in. We're not going to go full bore in all of this because, like, some of the things we're going to be talking about, there are hundreds of books, countless classes you could take at college, and so many more educated responses than what we can give. But we're going to kind of take this flyover approach in the coming weeks and hopefully peel back some layers. Because while we may not be able to easily answer the who am I, we can probably point to some things that we're not, that we sometimes think are the real us. So we're going to go kind of, anybody familiar with Magic School Bus? We had this conversation in pre-talk. I had to think, Mrs. Frizzle. So we're going to, like, get into our Magic School Bus. We're going to shrink down, and we're going to drive through the metaphorical layers of our consciousness. We're going to explore some of these things that people say about who we are. And I feel this is important because knowing yourself is not just something philosophers like Descartes tell us to do. This is a process of discovering what it is that we're working on. If we're trying to improve as human beings, what is it we're improving? We did a series last year called We Have Questions, and this could very well follow that same idea where we're going to be asking the questions that don't have the easy answers so that we can sit with them. For starters, when we're talking about who we are, what defines us, you have to acknowledge that right out of the gate, we are the subject trying to take on the role of the observer because we're in the thing that we're observing. Max Planck, who was a Nobel laureate, a theoretical physicist in 1932, had the foresight to describe this conflict. He says, science cannot solve the ultimate mystery of nature, and that is because in the last analysis, we ourselves are part of the mystery that we are trying to solve. This is the same Max Planck who gave us the Planck constant and the Planck unit and quantum theory, so he kind of knew what he was talking about a few things, and he's pointing to the fact that by virtue of our own existence, we are trying to step out of ourselves, and you can see right away the language that we try to use and how much it breaks down. We're trying to step outside of ourselves and observe who are we, but we can't do that any more than a fish can come outside of the water and realistically talk about the experience that they're immersed in. Pierre Deschardin, French theologian, scientist, deep thinker, he gave us another way to think about this, and I dropped this like a hand grenade in pre-talk because this provokes a lot of very different responses. Deschardins says, you are not a human being in search of a spiritual experience. You are a spiritual being immersed in a human experience. So right away, some of us are either nodding and saying, yeah, that sounds about right. And others are like, no, what does that mean? What do you mean spiritual? No, this is all up here. Okay, we're only getting deeper. So who is the real me? When we're trying to identify the real us, it sounds a lot like multiple personality disorders as you begin to kind of unpack the layers of who you are. Before long, you're sounding like Slim Shady. Will the real Slim Shady please stand up? I have to remind myself the age group and some of my examples. Ask your millennial children or grandchildren about Slim Shady. They would be happy to explain that to you. Who is the real me? Alan Watts says, most people live in what I call the greenhouse of concepts. They're surrounded themselves with ideas about who they are and what life is, what should and shouldn't be, but the real you is what remains when all of those concepts fall away. You've heard the description of an artist seeing a block of stone and seeing the thing that is there and chipping away everything that's not that finished masterpiece. So by process of deduction, we're going to work through some things to remind ourselves about these portions of our identity that we think of as us, that in reality have ways of distracting us from the real us. So let's start first with an easy one. Are we our bodies? Are we our bodies? You have heard the different examples of the processes of your body and how your body changes and regenerates. So even the cells that you have in your body have replaced themselves over the last 10 years. You're physically changed. There's the ship of Theseus or the Theseus paradox from Greek philosophers that say this ship that is sitting in harbor that the Greeks would use to send their offerings to the god, and it was sitting there waiting year after year, and in the process of time, as that ship is sitting in harbor, they would have to repair the ship and take off a plank and then replace that plank. And over time, philosophers would ask, is that ship still the same ship? So we'll start from day one. The ship is sitting there and a portion of the plank has come off. you take that plank off, you replace that piece of wood. Is it still the same ship? You can nod yes or no. Yeah. Right? It's only one plank that's changed. Or there's the sandhill paradox, that says that you have one grain of sand, and over here you have 10,000 grains of sand. We're saying this is a grain of sand that's a heap. If I take this 10,000 grains of sand and I remove one grain from there, now I have 9,999 grains of sand. Is it still a heap? Has the grain changed properties from going here to there? You see the questions that we start to get into as we explore the depths of who we are. And if you took all of the different components of yourself and could reconstruct yourself and carry your consciousness, is that still the same you? Daniel Gilbert captured this contradiction perfectly. He said, human beings are works in progress that mistakenly believe they are finished. We're a constantly regenerating human flesh sack made of bones with a brain that has these neurological processes. But we intuitively know that we're more than our skin and bones. We're more than our physical characteristics. And so let's go a little bit deeper. Are we our consciousness? And even that word is a tough one to describe, to define. We spent some time on that this morning. We're not going to go too deep into that, but we are going to just hit on the basics of what consciousness is. This self-awareness. John Locke's 1690 essay titled Concerning Human Understanding is one of the foundational works in Western philosophy that explores the nature of the human mind and its acquisition of consciousness. And you can just hang on for just a little bit if you're glassing over at this point. Locke had this theory of this blank slate that we emerge into the world. He called it the tabula rasa. The tabula rasa, this blank slate, we emerge into the world as a blank slate, and we're shaped by our experiences and our reflections on those experiences. Essentially, experiences being external things that happen to us, and then the reflection, which is the internal thoughts that we have about those things. Consciousness and knowledge, he said, arise from experience through sensation, or experiences, and reflection. But we know that our lives are constantly changing. Our experiences are constantly shifting. If you want to have some really, really interesting, deep existential questions to wrestle with, there's a book by Robert Saplansky called Determined that explores some of the new conversations about how much of our actions are generated by what we call free will, and how much of the way that we respond is conditioned through experiences, internal structure. Clearly, these are some deep conversations. These are some things that people go into, and there's a reason why it's worth wrestling with this, but we're not done yet. We're going to go a little bit deeper. So beyond the level of consciousness is this thing that we develop about our identity. One of the marks of consciousness is that there is a self and that this self is different from other. Some can argue that there's consciousness in plants and in animals. There's various forms of intelligence. Anybody who has seen My Octopus Teacher has spent some time thinking about the unique aspects of consciousness that just aren't easy to fit into a box. So we would say what separates us from the animals as human beings, as we put ourselves up on this tier of evolution, what separates us from the animals is our ability to form identities and through our memories to construct this identity, right? This is part of who we say we are. We're starting to get deeper into the what is the I that I'm referring to when I talk about myself? When people say Brad Ruggles is this, they're referring to these characteristics about myself that have been shaped over time and continue to evolve based on the experiences I have, the people I talk to, and more importantly, the time that I spend reflecting and the time that this brain begins to process what it is that I'm thinking and derive this sense of identity. And for most of us, we tend to stop here because some of the deepest and truest parts of ourselves are the things that come from this identity piece. And when your identity is called into question, you tend to react poorly because we so closely guard our sense of self. If someone accuses you of being a liar or a cheat, that hits you wrong because you know intuitively that that's not you. That's describing something about you that is not true. So are we our identities? Are we our memories? Locke was one of the first philosophers to tie personal identity to this ongoing process or this continuity of consciousness. He claimed that what makes someone the same person over time is not the sameness of body, or even, he would say, the sameness of a soul, but the persistence of consciousness, the ability to remember past experiences and recognize oneself as being the same person who had those experiences. Again, for many of us, we can kind of like start to agree with that or push back on that. We're saying, yes, there was a me that had experiences in the past. And it is the same person that is now standing here. But between that person and here, there's a whole host of change. I recently found a letter from 1999, December of 99. It was from our engagement time. And I read that letter, Lisa and I read that letter. And it's so fascinating if you've ever pulled out old journals or old notes to read things that you wrote and to deal with the cognitive dissonance of saying, I both wrote that and yet that does not feel like me. Does that sound fair? I've had to go through a lot of therapy in terms of integrating parts of myself that I've walled off because in my head it was easier to separate that part of me as happening to somebody else or someone else. Because to acknowledge that, to integrate that, means to incorporate it with the whole. I do feel there's some value, tremendous value, in incorporating the whole of your experiences. But to recognize that we are more than our memories. Those of you who have friends or loved ones in the early or advanced stages of dementia or Alzheimer's, as those memories go away, would we say that that person is becoming less themselves? If a person loses all memory, goes Jason Bourne and like loses it, are they a new person? So are we more than our memories? Are we more than our experiences? Am I my thinking mind? Harvard neuroscientist and professor of psychology, Joshua Green, talks about a dual process brain, and he uses an analogy that's helpful in this regard that I'm going to use. This is the same concept talked about if anybody's read Thinking Fast or Slow. The intuitive, natural, fast response to things versus the slower thinking response to things. So we're talking about our consciousness and the two different layers of our consciousness that have evolved within our brain. And he uses the analogy of a digital camera, and this is helpful for anybody who understands some basic principles of photography. But if you've ever gotten a camera, especially one of the newer digital SLRs, single lens reflex cameras that have some of the different lens attachments and stuff, there's an auto mode on there, and then there's a M, little M. You can switch the dial to that. you know, and that's the difference between automatic mode and what? Manual mode, right? So he would say that automatic mode, or this hot, this fast response, is our automatic default in how we respond to things. It's driven by our emotions, and it comes from the oldest part of our brain. The oldest reptilian part of our brain, it's fast and it's efficient because it evolved over time to focus on the really, really essential things in life. Fight, flight, feeding, freezing, or there's some other word about sex that would fit in there too. So those things are controlled by that level of our brain. It's the automatic response. It's that intuitive response and that thing that we step into so quickly because it's our emotional response and it's quicker to respond. Then there is the manual mode, or this slower thinking part. Again, if you're thinking in terms of the thinking fast or slow from Daniel's book, this would be the slower part that takes place in the frontal cortex. The most recent part of our brains to develop, also the most taxing, the hardest to use. If you've ever had a really emotional, difficult conversation where you've had to think really hard about what you were saying, when you were done, have you experienced that brain fatigue of having to use your brain so hard? And now research is showing us that brain energy is a measurable thing. We can use our brains in different ways, and it can tax us in different ways. This slower response, this more evolved response, takes more time, requires more space, silence, introspection, and contemplation. The problem arises when we try to apply automatic mode thinking to manual mode situations. When we so frequently identify with the reactive part of ourselves that we think of as us. And yet, as I'm wrapping up here, I'm gonna maybe poke some holes in that theory just a little bit, because we know that there is a deeper part of ourselves that is somehow observing these processes at work. If you've spent any time in meditation, especially mindfulness meditation, and we have a group going that Carrie has started, we've already got a good sign up for that. I'm really, really excited for that to start, because mindfulness is this process of awareness, bringing yourself to life as it is. It calls you to observe what is happening. And so as we slow down and create the space, our thinking mind begins to emerge. We begin to slow down, but then we even recognize that yet this frontal lobe, this part of ourselves that has evolved over time to give us this sense of identity, to allow us to separate us from others, to have future planning and forethought, and all these things that we think of as so advanced within our species. These are the same things that hold us back, that puts us in this predicament. That, as Ellen Watts says, trying to define yourself is like trying to bite your own teeth or kiss your own lips. It's this process of identifying who is the me that I'm referring to underneath all of this. This automatic versus manual mode thinking. One other good parallel, I think this one is in the bulletin, the quote from Thich Nhat Hanh. In neuroscience, they speak of background consciousness, or more subconscious actions, and that's equivalent to a Buddhist idea of store consciousness versus mind consciousness. So there's other language that's at play here. In Buddhism, Thich Nhat Hanh says, we speak of store consciousness as the part of our consciousness that always operates day or night, store consciousness of capable of receiving information, storing information, processing information, and learning. Mind consciousness is much slower. While you're driving, if you encounter something very quickly to avoid an accident, that is store consciousness. That's an automatic, quick response thing. It is learned and reacted very quickly. If you had to wait for your mind to make a decision, it might be too late. So we're now starting with our magic school bus to emerge on this realm of our consciousness that takes us deeper to the us that we refer to. It's deeper than our simple conscious awareness. It's deeper than our body. It's deeper even than our memories of who we are, which can be faulty. It's deeper than this identity that we cultivate in our response to the world. There is an us that thinks of itself. There is an us that can observe, if you give it space, everything. We speak of positive experiences. We used one example was given this morning in pre-talk that I love. We use language like losing ourselves to love, about falling out of ourselves, about selfless acts as being something good. As human beings, we have such a difficult relationship with this idea of self. And if your heads are not hurting yet after thinking about all those things here, we'll kind of land this bus here on a little bit of a more fun note here, because we're going to take some time in the coming weeks to really, really spend time in reflection about what's underneath the surface. These are conversations worth having. They're tied to so many other parts of ourselves, this idea of us and what we think of. Here's one last perspective that will push some buttons for some or maybe ring true to others. Meister Eckhart, when talking about the self, he says, "The eye through which I see God is the same eye through which God sees me. My eye and God's eye are one eye, one seeing, one knowing, one loving." Early on in my talks, I think one of the descriptions I used about myself was the label of psychonaut, which some of you asked, like, what is a psychonaut? A person who explores altered states of consciousness, often through the use of entheogens or entheogenic substances. And that word there means entheo, the divine or the God within. People who explore consciousness, like looking behind the curtain, like asking those kind of questions and placing themselves in situations where you're exploring exactly what is this thing that we call life. And there's a reason, isn't there, that out of all the crazy hippies from the 60s and the Beatles and all of their trippy experiences, why we keep coming back to things like love as being the source of everything. All you need is love. So today, as we set aside kind of our thinking caps and this hard process of like the philosophical questions that go along with that, let's spend some time today reflecting on our deepest self as part of something bigger than us. What came out of pre-talk that I loved is person after person who have very different philosophical and psychological beliefs about where our identity comes from, that all agree that at the end of the day, what matters is this, right? Let's not spend so much time navel-gazing that we forget to look up and remember that we are part of a whole. Thank you, friends, for sharing this time with me. I say to you, namaste, because I believe there is something in me that greets and recognizes that same thing in you. I appreciate the time and the space for us to just ask those kind of fun questions and wrestle what that looks like. Namaste.